The following is a presentation of the American College of Osteopathic Internists.
Welcome to the 2017 Internal Medicine Board Review Course, sponsored by the American College of Osteopathic Internists. The course was held March 22nd through 26th, 2017, at the JW Marriott Las Vegas Resort and Spa. The course featured nationally known speakers presenting a wide variety of topics of interest to the internist preparing for certification or recertification in the specialty of internal medicine. Glomerulonephritis, Diagnosis and Management is presented by Dr. John Pryor.
What I'd like to do is take some of Mark's information and do a clinical application to this. And specifically, what I'm going to talk about is glomerulonephritis. So nephrologists by nature are nerds. Like, we are the nerdiest people around, except for Mark, of course, but you know, the other people I know. And this is one of the reasons we go into nephrology, because this is an interesting group of diseases to diagnose and to take care of. So without further ado, I'm going to start with a case. This is a 44-year-old woman who was admitted from her primary care office because she was having dyspnea and hypertension. She really hadn't felt well for 3 or 4 months, and she just felt kind of crappy. She kept having bronchitis with wheezing. She does not have a history of asthma. She really didn't have much in the way of past medical history. Maybe she had some seasonal allergies, and that's about it. Really no significant family or social history. I mean, she was kind of boring as far as those types of things. When we got to see her in the hospital, her blood pressure was elevated, which was kind of weird in somebody who never had hypertension before. She was kind of sick because her heart rate was 112, and she looked pale and she was wheezing with a few crackles. And what got her attention and what got the nephrologist to come and see her is that her BUN and creatinine were elevated, 61 and 3.8, with no previous history of any type of kidney disease. Her white count was high at 11.08, and interestingly enough, she had 15% eosinophils. And what got our interest is the fact that she had plus 4 protein, 10 to 20 RBCs and 5 WBCs. And microscopic, her urine protein creatinine ratio is about 4, and her urine albumin creatinine ratio was 3,300, was 3.3. So I'll explain a little bit about you, but first I'm going to show you her chest x-ray, which is not super impressive. But there are some, I don't know if this works or not, but there are some nodules here, there's a nodule there. So it was an abnormal chest x-ray, but not the craziest thing I've ever seen. And if you were paying attention and did nod off during Mark's talk, you'd see that this is a cast. This was actually her urinalysis. And it's a red cell cast. So this is a cast, it's got red cells in it. What we do is we usually typically, the red cell is the ruler of the urinalysis. So we look at the urinalysis and we look at a red cell. If the cells inside the cast are the same cell as a red cell, then that's a red cell cast. If they're bigger, then it's white cell cast or epithelial cell cast. And we also saw on her urinalysis that she had a lot of beat up looking cells. This looks like the pictures that Mark showed you of TTP, didn't it? So what this is, these are dysmorphic red cells because they're trying to squeeze through an abnormal glomerular basement membrane. So what does she have? And Mark gave you a nice talk about the background and all the other things, but the question when it comes down to it is, when we see these patients, what do they have? So the possibilities that we entertained were, could she have lupus? Could she have Henoch-Schönlein-Purpura? Could she have this thing called Sjögren-Strauss disease, which is now called eosinophilic granulomatous polyangiitis? Could she have a granulomatous polyangiitis, which used to be called Wegener's, or could she have microscopic PN? At this point, I don't know. I just know that she's sick and she's got what looks like glomerular disease. So how do we approach this? When we think about glomerular disease, we think about people that have hematuria or proteinuria or both. We divide them into two categories, those people that have proliferative glomerulonephritis, which have hematuria and proteinuria, and those people that have basement membrane disease, those people that just have proteinuria. What I learned about this in medical school was nephritis versus nephrosis, but we really don't use those things anymore because they're really not useful categories for us to talk about. So she had what we would say as a proliferative glomerulonephritis because she had hematuria and she had proteinuria. So it means that there's cellular infiltration of the glomeruli. and there's immune cells that are attracted because of inflammation, and then there's activation of complement, and then there's immune complexes. And it leads to holes punched in the glomerular basement membrane that are big enough to put red cells through it. And we know that if we look at these histologically, mild diseases, mesangial, and severe diseases is crescenting, and I'll show you what I mean by that. So mesangium is the support structure. Focal and segmental means that's the endothelium is involved. Diffuse means all the endotheliums involved, and crescentic means epithelial, just the epithelial side. So that's the progress of how inflammation occurs in the kidney. If it's mild, it starts in the mesangium, then it goes to the endothelium, and if it's really bad, it goes breaks through this and goes into the epithelial side, and that's called crescentic. So this is a cartoon just showing this. So the blue is the mesangium, which is the support structure. This is the endothelium cell, and this is the epithelial side. So inflammation happens here, then happens here, and then happens here. What diseases can cause this inflammation? Every damn disease that Mark showed you. So just knowing the histology, and this is the way I learned glomerulonephritis, was knowing the histology. I kept going through this, and I would look at mesangial GN, and what's the differential diagnosis? And diffuse proliferative GN, what's the differential diagnosis? Crescentic GN, what's the differential diagnosis? The same damn thing every time. So histology certainly tells you severity of disease, but histology does not give you a diagnosis, unfortunately. So again, this is the mesangium, the blue, and then you see these nice red things, which are epithelial cells, and then this is Bowman's capsule or epithelium. So this is what a glomerulus looks like on biopsy. It has these nice capillary loops with a few cells here and there. The pink stuff is the mesangium. When you start to get inflammation in the mesangium, you start to see cells get together, proliferating. Okay, so that's mesangial GN. The rest of the glomerulus looks pretty normal. The epithelial side looks pretty normal. And then once it starts to involve the endothelium, you see this is swollen. There's no nice capillary loops that are open. And if you look closely, you'll see PMNs that are here. But again, the epithelium looks pretty good. And then finally, you now start to see this epithelial cell proliferation. That's called crescentic. So it went from the mesangium into the endothelium and into the epithelial side, and that's called crescentic glomerulonephritis. And when Mark talked about acute kidney injury, these are the people with GN that get acute kidney injury. So if they have severe enough inflammation, they can get crescentic glomerulonephritis and acute kidney injury. And this is a red cell cast in situ. This is a tubular lumen with TAM horsefall protein with red cells in it. So when we biopsy these people, we can actually see the red cell cast in situ. So that's well and good, but what about Our Lady? What does she have? Well, I don't really even know any more now than I did before. I'm going to guess that she probably had crescentic glomerulonephritis because her renal function was bad, but I have no idea what disease is causing this or what type she has. So there's a really simple approach that we have that actually works in real life, and lo and behold, it works in board situations. So when you take boards, if you use the same approach, you'll get the same answer as if you were taking care of a patient in the hospital. So it asks two simple questions. First question is, do you have systemic disease, or is this just kidney disease? So obviously in this woman, she had systemic disease, right? She had pulmonary disease, she had weight loss, she felt crappy, and she also had kidney disease. So she had a systemic disease. And then the second question is, what are your complements? Are they normal or are they low? So that's really it, just two questions. And you can come up with a pretty close answer to what's going on. So if you look here, there's different categories here. So if you have a systemic disease, that's the top half of this. You can have a low complement systemic disease, such as lupus or mixed cryo or post-infectious glomerulonephritis, or you can have a normal complement disease. So it would be nice if we knew what her complements were. We could have put her into one of these quadrants. And then if she has a low complement disease that's just a kidney disease, that's the lower left corner. And if she has a kidney disease that has normal complements, that's the lower right corner. So by putting that, we're getting a little bit closer to our diagnosis. Before, we really didn't have much of it. We knew she was sick, we knew her kidneys were sick, but we didn't know which disease was causing this. So we'll just run through them pretty quickly. So the low complement systemic diseases, of which lupus is the prototype. It's an immune complex disease. We all knew this from the beginning. And if you looked at how they classify lupus nephritis, it's actually mesangial to crescentic. They classify it anywhere from 1 through 7, and 1 through 4 are anywhere from mesangial to crescentic. So lupus is an immune complex disease. What immune complex is? Anything you can think of. It can be IgA, it can be IgG, it can be IgM, it can be any immune complex that you can think of. They go to the kidney, they attract cellular infiltration, they cause proliferation within the kidney. To make the diagnosis of this, typically it's a low complement disease, it's a systemic disease, and they typically have ANA positive. So ANA negative lupus does not cause glomerulonephritis, okay? It might cause some membranous, it might cause proteinuria, but it never causes. So if your ANA is negative, you ain't got lupus nephritis, okay? So typically we screen these people with an ANA, and we might do more specific antibodies, such as DNA and anti-Smith. Mixed cryo is an interesting disease that we see now mostly due to hepatitis C, which is highlighted in yellow. But mixed cryoglobulin is that you have cryoglobulins. They could be monoclonal because you have a lymphoma. They could be polyclonal, monoclonal, because you have a lymphoproliferative disease such as lymphoma, et cetera. Or they can be polyclonal, oftentimes due to an infection, all right? So the polyclonal mixed cryoglobulinemia, the most common reason we see this is we see this with hepatitis C. Surprisingly not, hepatitis C antibody is a cryoglobulin. So it's actually to the point where if you check them for hepatitis C by antibodies alone, that antibody will have precipitated by the time you take it to the lab. So oftentimes these people are anti-hepatitis C antibody negative. So again, hepatitis C antibody is a cryoglobulin, so you may actually have a negative test. That's why we advocate using hepatitis C by PCR or do a viral load on these patients. The other types of cryoglobulin, rheumatoid factor. Did you know that rheumatoid factor was a cryoglobulin? It's a cryoglobulin. So anything that's rheumatoid factor positive can have mixed cryoglobulinemia. Post-infectious glomerulonephritis, there's almost any infection 2 to 3 weeks after the infection can have an immune complex density that's good enough that it can get deposited in the kidney. The classic post-infectious that we talked about before was strep, but we see staph now. So I can say that probably 4 times a year I see somebody that had a staph infection and 2 weeks later I see them because they have acute kidney injury. And oftentimes these people have post-staph GN. So post-infectious GN, the one we see the most now is staph, but there are other things obviously that can cause it. There used to be a thing called shunt nephritis. Shunt nephritis was when kids got their VP shunts infected. So any type of infection 2 to 3 weeks later can result in immune complex deposition within the kidney and can cause glomerulonephritis. So remember the 2 to 3 weeks because that's important, and also remember that this is a low complement problem. The low complement renal diseases are one of two, post-strep GN. And the reason we say post-strep GN is just a renal disease is by the time you see them, the strep infection is gone. They have no systemic symptoms of the strep infection. So the strep, the skin and soft tissue infection or the pharyngitis is completely gone. And at that point, all they really present with is hypertension, proteinuria, hematuria, and some edema formation. As far as labs in this, labs unfortunately are really, I would venture to say that 60 to 70% of us here are ASO positive. 60 to 70% of us are anti-DNAs positive, so those tests are kind of worthless. That's like saying you have to have a nose to be able to have post-strep GN, so that's really kind of worthless. So it's really a clinical diagnosis. You had pharyngitis 3 weeks ago. You had a skin and soft tissue infection 3 weeks ago. And now you have low complements and you have what looks like glomerulonephritis. Membranous proliferative GN is the final category. And this is the second manifestation of hepatitis C that we see. So we rarely see this disease in adults. This is an adolescent disease, but when we see it in adults, 90% of those patients, this is hepatitis C. And they now have a classification. The classification I don't think is important for board purposes, but at least allows us to think of the different things that can cause membranous proliferative GN. Okay. Now we're switched over to the other side. Okay, so these are all the people that have normal complements and systemic disease. So we did the low complement diseases. Now we're doing the normal complements and systemic diseases. And these are the diseases that, again, this is why people go into nephrology, because they're an interesting group of diseases. Anything from good pasture syndrome to granulomatous polyangiitis to microscopic PAN to eosinophilic granulomatous polyangiitis and Henoch Schönlein purpura. So good pastures, Mark showed you nice pictures and told you what this is. It's a disease where you develop antibodies to a non-constant region of type 4 collagen. The interesting thing about this, from a science standpoint, is there's a thing called Alport syndrome. Alport syndrome is one type of hereditary nephritis. It lacks this antigen. Okay, so a person with Alports can never get good pastures syndrome because they don't develop antibodies to something they don't have. Interestingly enough, that when you put a normal kidney into an Alport's person, they can get good pastures because now they've seen this antigen for the first time. So anyway, so good pastures is something that they present with either alveolar hemorrhage plus glomerulonephritis. They can present with just plain alveolar hemorrhage, or they can present with just plain glomerulonephritis. So it's one of the pulmonary renal syndromes you'll hear about all the time. Anti-GBM is positive. IgG anti-GBM is positive 90% of the time. And if you add IgA onto that, you'll get up to about 98%. So if you have a negative anti-GBM antibody, you don't have the disease. We see people now that present, one-third of them present like a vasculitis. They present like this woman did. 3 to 4 months of feeling crappy, and then boom. And oftentimes those people are ANCA positive. So they have both ANCA positivity and anti-GBM positivity. And this is the nice picture that they show with linear IgG. Contrast that to the medical school. When we learned it in medical school, we got to see this one, or we got to see this thing called lumpy bumpy, which is immune complex gene. But this is an antibody specifically to one of the basement membrane antigens. The vasculitis is a real common. So if you think of the vasculitis that we learned about large vessel, small and medium vessel, and then we learn about small vessel vasculitis. So polyarteritis nodosa is a small and medium small and medium vessel vasculitis. So that's where you get intra-abdominal disease or renal arterial disease, but you do not get capillaryitis and vasculitis. What we see in the kidney is a small vessel vasculitis. And any small vessel vasculitis can affect the kidneys. So granulomatous polyangiitis is one of the more common ones that we see. Advances have really been made over the past 10 years because of this thing called the ANCA antibody. They actually found out that there's antibodies to antigens within a neutrophil. Lo and behold, that's a marker for the disease, and lo and behold, that's what activates neutrophils to cause the glomerulonephritis. The specific antigen for this is proteinase 3, which is in the granules of neutrophils. You all might have learned it as Wegener's. Dr. Wegener was not a very nice man, and he participated in not very nice stuff, so he's been banned at this point. I'm not allowed to talk about politics, they told me, so I will not talk about politics. So anyway, this is a disease. So typically, classically, this is a disease that presents with upper respiratory tract problems. So people have sinusitis, they have hearing loss, but they also can affect the lower respiratory tract, which they can come to you with alveolar hemorrhage and respiratory failure, as well as glomerulonephritis. These are anti-neutrophil positive patients with proteinase 3. Then there's a thing called microscopic polyangiitis. This is a disease that has gone through a million different names. But nowadays, it's a small vessel vasculitis. It's not polyangiitis nodosa. It's polyarteritis nodosa. So it's microscopic. It means that it affects the capillaries and arterioles. So this is a disease that is a systemic disease that can affect any little blood vessel in the body. So it could affect the brain, it can affect the vasa nervorum and cause mononephritis multiplex, it can affect the skin and cause a skin rash, it can affect the kidneys. And lo and behold, this one is positive for another ANCA antibody, this time for myeloperoxidase. So it's an ANCA-related disease. So now this is designated as microscopic polyangiitis. Hanuk Schoenlein Purpura hasn't been, they haven't taken the name away from Hanuk or Schoenlein. I don't know, they must have been good guys, so they were women, they were, it wasn't taken care of. And Mark showed you nice pictures of HSP, but this is a IGA small vessel vasculitis. That's the something that's seen mostly in adolescents, but we see it secondarily in adults post staph infection or post other types of, we see it with gastrointestinal illness every so often. But we see a fair amount of it with post-staph. So post-staph can give you just post-infectious glomerulonephritis, or it can give you an IgA vasculitis. And finally, there's a disease called eosinophilic granulomatous polyangiitis. Again, we must not like Sjögren-Strauss. We got rid of them. And now it's called eosinophilic granulomatous polyangiitis. So this is a small vessel vasculitis associated with eosinophilia and asthma. We saw a big outbreak of it when the leukotriene inhibitors came out because people were rapidly tapered off the steroids, and lo and behold, they started to get this vasculitis. It mostly affects the lungs, but it can occasionally affects the kidneys, and if it affects the kidneys, oftentimes it's MPO positive, so it's another ANCA positive vasculitis. All right, then finally, there's the normal complement renal diseases, of which IgA is the prototype. So IgA is the most common GN that's seen in the world, proliferative GN that's seen in the world. Typically, they get hematuria intercurrent with their respiratory or GI illness, right? So post-infectious is 2 to 3 weeks after. This is intercurrent at the same time. Post-infectious has low complements. This has normal complements, okay? That's the distinguishing characteristics. So there's a disease, there's something called benign hematuria, which you all might see in the office. These are people that have hematuria, but nothing else. So they have chronic hematuria, and when you look at them, they don't have hypertension, they don't have chronic kidney disease, they don't have proteinuria, they don't have systemic disease at all. And you, these people, typically, if you biopsy them and do 24-hour urines, oftentimes are a conglomeration of a little bit of IgA, a little bit of this thing called thin basement membrane disease, which is usually typically the female presentation of Alport syndrome. They might have hypercalciuria. So these are people that you can follow in the office on a yearly basis, and typically they rarely progress. And anybody that comes to you with hematuria, you have to do, you should image their kidneys if they're over age 50, you should image their kidneys if they present to you with chronic hematuria, and if they have hematuria and they're more than 50, they should all get cystoscopy because bladder cancer is so easy to treat when it's local, and they should all get cystoscopy if they're 40 years old or older and a smoker. So Mark talked a lot about TTP and hemolytic uremic syndrome. I include this because this looks like a GN. So anytime I see people that come to see me and I think, I bet you this person has a GN, the next thing I look at is their platelet count. And if their platelet count is low, the next thing I look at is a peripheral smear. And if they have more than 2 schistocytes per high power field, then I will aggressively work them up and oftentimes treat them for hemolytic uremic syndrome or for TTP. And Mark showed you a nice picture, so we don't need that. And finally, Mark also talked to you a little bit about interstitial nephritis. For me, when I'm looking at patients, I want to know, do I think the disease is glomerular or do I think it's interstitial? So typically, interstitial nephritis presents with not a lot of hypertension, not a lot of volume overload. They may or may not have eosinophilia. They could have a rash, but they may not have a rash. But people with glomerular disease present with hypertension, proteinuria, and edema formation. So that's the differentiating factor for me. The urine, on the other hand, looks a lot alike, except for the proteinuria part of it. So here's our case again. You can say to me prior, it took you a damn long time to get back to this. So here we have she had normal C3 and normal C4. All right. So we said she's got a systemic disease. She's got normal complements, that means that she's in that top right category. Just to screw things up, her S-peptin showed a monoclonal lambda, her ANA was negative, her rheumatoid factor C-ANCA was negative, which is typical of Wegener's, but her P-ANCA was actually positive for myeloperoxidase antibodies, interestingly enough. Bone marrow biopsy didn't show myeloma. She had a CT of chest, which I'm going to show you, and then we did a renal biopsy on her, so I'm going to show you that quickly. On the CT of the chest, you can actually see some nodular densities where her vasculitis was being affected here. And this is her biopsy. And her biopsy, remember I showed you about biopsy? So this is a crescent around the outside. So she had crescentic glomerulonephritis. Again, the biopsy doesn't tell me anything. It doesn't tell me her disease, right? It just tells me how severe it was. And this is the interstitium of her biopsy. And this just showed a lot of eosinophils. So if we go through this, she's in the top right corner. So it's good pastures, GPA, HSP, microscopic polyangiitis, and Sjögren's Trout. So it's not good pastures. She doesn't have GPA because she's PR3 negative. She doesn't have HSP, which is not ANCA positive. So you're left with microscopic polyangiitis or Sjögren's Trout disease. Remember, she had eosinophilia. So her diagnosis is eosinophilic granulomatous polyangiitis, which we could have got to without the biopsy probably. All right, so that's really, so the clinical approach to this is get you to the, so really I need to know what disease she has. I don't need to know that she's got crescentic glomerulonephritis. I already know that. I need to get to the place where I could treat her. And this is a disease that's super sensitive to steroids, and we've treated her with steroids, and she's had, her creatinine, which was 3.6, is down to 1.7. So we've at least had some remission in her disease, and her eosinophilia has gone away, and her systemic symptoms are better. Okay. So second case is going to be the different half, the other side of this. So this is an African-American guy who presents with worsening edema of 3 months' duration. He's been diabetic for only 2 years. He's been hypertensive for only 2 years. He came into the hospital 2 years ago with a motor vehicle accident. That's why he's had that. That's the coincidence there. On physical exam, on history, he's got a distal polyneuropathy. He's got some proliferative retinopathy, which is kind of weird, especially in light of the fact he's only been diabetic for 2 years. His urine shows that his urine protein creatinine ratio is 6.6, consistent with 6.6 grams. He's got a urine albumin creatinine ratio of 4,200. And we do a ratio of the albumin to protein, and that gives us a number. So if the albumin to protein ratio is more than 50%, so if 50% of the proteinuria is albumin, then that means this is probably glomerular disease. It's very helpful to do. There's another slide about that. So which of these things could this person have? Could they have FSGS? Could they have amyloidosis? Could they have diabetic glomerulosclerosis? Minimal change or membranous? We don't have a nice clinical schema for this, I have to say. I wish we did. But it's important to know the amount of proteinuria is important. So if you have a urine protein creatinine ratio of more than a gram, it's almost always going to be glomerular disease. Okay, and that's because if you look at this, this is the 24-hour urines versus UPC, which is the urine protein creatinine ratio, and it's a pretty straight line relationship. So whatever you get on UPC is what you would have gotten if you did a 24-hour urine. And I also, more recently over the past year or two, have set up ratios between the amount of albumin that's in the urine and the amount of protein in the urine. And I know that if it's more than 50%, then that's glomerular disease. I know that if it's less than 25%, lo and behold, it's myeloma cast nephropathy. And if it's between 25% and 50%, typically those are people that have chronic interstitial or vascular disease. So using this ratio has been very helpful for me. Yeah, we're not going to go a whole lot into it, but the basic schema, this is a glomerular basement membrane with nice little podocytes there. I don't think we need to do that. And there's various patterns of injury with podocyte disease. So this is disease of basement membrane and podocyte disease, and these are the five that we're going to go through quickly. So minimal change disease is an interesting disease in that nothing really happens to the kidney except for the charge of those glomerular of those pores. Because of the charge in the pores, then you start to get proteinuria, albuminuria. In adults, we see occasionally you have so much proteinuria that you can have acute kidney injury because of hypo-onconic, because of the oncotic gradient that you get. And we oftentimes see this in kids. This is typically the nephrotic syndrome of children, and it's usually steroid-responsive nephrotic syndrome of children. But it's because of cytokines. We don't know what cytokines. We just know that if we treat with steroids that we decrease cytokine production, it goes away. And so this is the thing we showed you before, where you have these nice little podocytes sitting on top of the glomerular basement membrane here and here. And this is what happens when you have minimal change diseases. These are all effaced, so they're all fused together. So on light microscopy, it looks perfectly normal, but on electron microscopy, you see the effacement of the foot processes. Second disorder in this category is membranous GN. Membranous is an interesting disease. And that now this basement membrane is attacked. And how is it attacked? It's attacked because you have immune complex deposition within the glomerular basement membrane. Why do you get immune complex deposition? Because there's a planted antigen. So there's an antigen within the glomerular basement membrane. It might be a cancer antigen, or it might be this phospholipoprotein A1, where you have an antigen that's within the glomerular basement membrane, and then you get these immune complex formations that will cause disrupt the that will disrupt the glomerular basement membrane structure, and this is what it looks like. So here's the immune complexes to the phospholipoprotein A2, I'm sorry. And then this is what you see on electron microscopy, these nice humps in here. These are immune complexes. They're to some planted antigen, and it disrupts the structure of the glomerular basement membrane and causes progressive renal disease. FSGS is a disease that's caused by replacement of the same basement membrane now with scarring. There's multiple different types of this, but really what you have to know is there's an idiopathic variety that we see oftentimes in African American and in families, and then there's secondary. This is HIV nephropathy, this is hyperfiltration nephropathy, this is the one that we see. So it's the second most common glomerular nephritis in the world. It's the most common urban nephritis. And what you see here, this is a normal glomerulus, and this is a sclerotic glomerulus. So half of it is abnormal, so it's focal. It's segmental, and if I looked at another glomerulus over here, it'd be okay. It would be normal. Finally, diabetic glomerulosclerosis is the most common reason for end-stage renal disease and chronic kidney disease in the country. And I guess I didn't have a picture. I thought I had a picture of that. Protein deposition disease, Mark went into extensively and showed you these beautiful apple green birefringence. But the next disease that we see in this are people that have amyloidosis or light chain deposition disease, or this thing called fibrillar or immunotactinary. So these are people that all have disorders that an abnormal protein is deposited in the glomerulus in the periglomerular fashion. So if it's a degraded light chain, it's called AL amyloid, and that's oftentimes with myeloma. If it's a degraded inflammatory protein, it's called AA amyloidosis. That's what we used to see in rheumatoid arthritis, but now we see with chronic osteomyelitis. If it's a plain light chain, it's called light chain deposition disease. And if it's an intact immunoglobulin, it's called immunotactoid or fibrillar. And Mark showed you these nice pictures, but I don't think you need to see any more of them. Okay, so what glomerular disease does this patient have? There's not a nice clinical, the other one, we were pretty sure what this person had before we ever biopsied her. We don't have this nice schema for doing this. So in this case, aside from doing some limited serology such as ANA and HIV and hepatitis studies, really the end result is we always have to biopsy these people. And so we biopsied this person, and this is diabetic glomerulosclerosis. This is Kimball Steele Wilson's lesions. Seen in both. So despite the fact the person only had 2 years of diabetes, as usual, type 2 diabetes, you really have no idea of the onset of disease. All right, so this is diabetic glomerulosclerosis.